the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war!
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. Joining me is retired Air Force Major General Edward Meckenbauer, a 1964 graduate of the Air Force Academy. Only 2 years after leaving Colorado Springs, he found himself in the thick of war as a member of the 390th Tactical Fighter Squadron at Da Nang, Vietnam. He flew 113 missions, most of them over North Vietnam, before he was shot down and captured in June of 1967. He spent almost 6 years as a prisoner of war. His chronicle begins in Morgantown, West Virginia.
I was the oldest of 8 kids, born to Ed and Helen Meckenbauer, and my father was a welder and a steam fitter. So we did a lot of traveling around looking for work. He wasn't inducted into the Navy into the Second World War until 1946 because he was part of a critical skill. I was born in Morgantown, West Virginia in 1942. I spent the first 2 weeks of my life there and was never back until September 11, 2001, when I drove back from Washington that fateful day, having been in the Pentagon Annex that morning when the attacks occurred. And so as a result, I can honestly say at one point in my life, I lived longer in Hanoi than any other single place, because we did a lot of traveling around Pennsylvania.
Dubious distinction.
Right. And Albuquerque, New Mexico. So where the family still calls Albuquerque, New Mexico home. That was the homestead, so to say.
Well, what were the influences on you of being in a family that large and an itinerant father?
Get a good scholarship, and oh, by the way, I bet you $5 if you try for a service academy appointment, you can make it, because your help is going to be in a scholarship you can earn or something. That was the only motivation I had for even considering a military career, is that my father bet me $5 if I tried, took the civil service exams, competed for a service academy appointment, that I'd make it. And the day I left, I borrowed $5 from my mother to pay my father the $5 I lost.
Well, you did make it.
I did make it.
And off you went to Colorado Springs.
Yes, sir. Yep.
Class of 1964.
Class 1964. The first time I was ever in an airplane was on the 26th of June, flying to Colorado Springs in 1960.
What was life like for you at the academy in those days?
I loved it. I mean, we were the sixth class. The place was still new. A lot of aura about it. A lot of it wasn't even built. Of course, the physical plant that's out there now is quite different in some respects. The chapel was built while we were there. The new Sajan Hall was built, you know, afterwards. Mitchell Hall was changed. The academic complex, obviously, much bigger. When I went there, there were 1,600 cadets the first year. We grew to 2,400 and now 4,000. So a lot of physical changes. But at the same time, you know, the environment is still very much the same. And I loved it. I never, ever wanted to leave. I never, ever second-guessed, you know, the challenge I got from my father and my acceptance. I loved every day of it.
Well, it's funny because we were talking to a classmate of yours, Steve Ritchie, yesterday, as a matter of fact, and he made the comment that once he graduated and left that gate, he never wanted to go back again, and now he lives looking at it all the time.
Yeah, everybody always says, you know, it's a great place to be from, or the best picture of a service academy, I'm sure, in your family's experience, and Naval Academy's in the rearview mirror of a car. And a lot of guys don't want to go back. But over the years, you learn to appreciate the fact that these service academies are unique, and they provide a unique opportunity, not just for your own personal development and the fact that, you know, when you retire, you get a nice government check every month, but just for the friendships and the attitudes and the way that it shapes everything about your life. Mm-hmm. And so I think over the years, yeah, you may not be too excited about it, graduation day, about ever going back, but I find myself going back more and more, you know, to talk to kids and being every time impressed by the young men and women who are in our service academies today.
What was your career path after graduation?
Well, I always wanted to be, after I got there, a fighter pilot, and that's exactly what I did. Is I went off and went to F-4 school at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, and then went to RAF Bentwaters, England, for a first assignment in the F-4C. And back in those days, we had pilots in the back seat of the F-4. And over in Europe, I was fortunate, through an unfortunate circumstance, to become an aircraft commander and upgraded to aircraft commander in Europe, and then went to Vietnam as one of two first lieutenant aircraft commanders in the F-4C at the time. And, in fact, had yet another one of my classmates, fortunate to have Kevin McManus from the Class of 64 of the Air Force Academy, as my pilot system operator in Vietnam for a lot of, for most of the missions we flew. We flew 113 missions, 80 of which were over north, or 79 and a half, if you will, over North Vietnam. I came back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base after 6 years in Hanoi. Was a test pilot in 4950th Test Wing at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, getting 80 hours a month flying just about anything and everything that we had in the test wing there, loving it. The Air Force, of course, you know, you're obviously a military man yourself. Military never makes any dumb decisions. Everything's always well thought out, very rational, rigorous. The Air Force in those days had a thing called aviation service gates. 132 months, 11 years, you stopped doing that, and you went off and did something else. I said, time out. I spent six of those 11 years sucking my thumb in jail. You know, I don't have 11 years of flying service. I have aviation service, but not flying service. I said, no, you got to go do something else. So with that, I went about 10 miles away to the local Air National Guard outfit and said, you guys need any pilots? I said, yeah. They're flying F-100s at the time. And so I resigned my regular commission. I spent the next year, 16 years, defending Ohio from Kentucky, Indiana, West Virginia as a member of the Ohio Air National Guard.
Well, I'm a Kentuckian by birth.
There you go.
I know it needs defending.
Yeah, right. And after 16 years of doing that, and I know now you can edit this down to a reasonable answer. I'm giving you to your question. I went on to, I was playing golf one day with a fellow by the name of Charlie McDonald, a four-star commander of Air Force Logistics Command at the time. He said, how are things going at it? I said, absolutely great, sir. I said, I'm getting ready to retire. And he said, why? What do you mean retire? I said, well, I'm coming up on 28 years, lieutenant colonel, and that's it. And he said, to which you are able to achieve success. And you just kind of focus, and then you put your talents there. I mean, I might have been a lousy truck driver. I might have been a bad airline pilot, you know, but it just turned out, you know, okay, I had the skills to be an Air Force officer, whatever that means. You know, other people like John McCain went into politics because they had a gift of communication and a charisma. Bud Day, you know, he was a successful lawyer, not because he's the most eloquent guy or he's the best looking guy, because he's the most dedicated and tenacious once he starts chewing on the bone. Orson Swindell, as I said, gee whiz, you know, here's a success for a Marine. I mean, that's almost an oxymoron. But again, you know, he had personality traits that he was able to identify there, and a focus that he was able to develop after he got out of jail that led him on to success. And I think, excuse me, I mean, a lot of guys just kind of really discerned at a relatively young age, during their period in Vietnam, what it was they really wanted to do with their life. And they focused the God-given talents that they had to achieve success in that respect. That's probably, it was just more of a wake-up call, rap on the head, to, you know, what do you really want to make of yourself, as opposed to just kind of bumbling through and seeing what happens at the end.
How much did you know about what was going on in the outside world, except for what they wanted you to know?
Yeah. Really none. You know, I was one of those guys, wasn't allowed to send or receive any mail. So the only outside world contact we had was basically the anti-war stuff that periodically the Vietnamese would dump on us. And
so you knew that Jane Fonda had been there, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we had the voice of the camp that came on at least once a day, you know, spewing the voice of Vietnam. And we just called it the voice of the camp. Spewing the party line and about how the successes of the glorious fraternalistic communist forces were in defeating the imperialist Yankee aggressors in the South and their lackey henchmen. You know, yeah, we got that all the time. So you just kind of tune that out. And then it got to the point for a while that the Vietnamese would make us put on our long clothes, as we call it, the striped pajamas that we only wore during interrogations or when they wanted us to sit and listen to the camp radio and study and think about our sins.
But were you able to glean anything even from their propaganda? For example, about the anti-war movement in the United States, did you realize the proportions that it had reached and that it had momentum or what?
I think, you know, that as polarized as the anti-war movement was, we were as strident in believing that it was all fictitious, that it was just a matter of the perspective at which the camera was sitting. Certainly there weren't 150,000 or half a million or even 10,000 people at these anti-war meetings. It just wouldn't happen. So we were probably a little bit in denial and then a little bit in rejection and feeling that anything that the Vietnamese gave us was obviously not correct right from the get-go. So so when we came home, it was probably the first time we really developed an appreciation for, well, not an appreciation, a sense of the magnitude of the anti-war activity and the fact that some of what the Vietnamese said probably was accurate. It wasn't as bad. I mean, there weren't 10 million people marching, you know, in the nation's capital, as they probably told us. You know, it might have been, you know, half a million or whatever number it was. It was only after the fact that we really developed an understanding of the fact that the Vietnam War really was a socially and politically divisive event.
How did you find out you were coming home?
Well, the Vietnamese, in typical Vietnamese fashion, didn't tell us until the 11th hour of the fifth day. And by the 12th hour of the fifth day, according to the protocols, they had to tell us that the war was over. And I had spent the last 6 months in a camp up on the Chinese border, which, you know, was ultimately even viewed as a bad boy camp or a place to hide some Americans so far in Vietnam that nobody could ever find them. I don't know what the real rationale was for sending 100 or so of us up there. But they brought us down from that camp in the middle of January. Obviously, the peace talks were going, and the definitive resolution, I guess, was struck on the 22nd of January, if give or take a day or two. And to my recollection, by the 27th of January 1973, the Vietnamese had to explain to us what the protocols were ending the war and for our repatriation. And as I said, on the fourth day, at the 11th hour, the Vietnamese got us all in the courtyard. And this is the first time they ever allowed us to stand in a military formation with a whole group from different rooms. They always, even in the good times, they were never, you know, 50 or 60 or 100 guys outside at one time in a common area. And they read the protocols addressing the end of the war and the repatriation of the POWs. Essentially, it was going to be in four groups, coincident with the removal of the last four quarters of the total number of American troops in South Vietnam. And when it was all done, we just all very quietly walked back into our room. And I think the Vietnamese and all of the people who were standing around with the cameras and International Control Commission, who was there at the time, were expecting a bunch of hooping and hollering and jumping up and down and hand slapping and all the rest of that. But it wasn't the peep, and it wasn't anything that was said to us by the senior ranking people. But we stood there just kind of in some sort of a makeshift military formation. They read the protocols and quietly went back to the room. And different people have different takes on why we just kind of serendipitously had. I mean, there really was nobody who did anything, no smiling. Either we individually felt it too good to be true, it's another lie, it may be true, but it's going to go south before we get out of here. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty much...
Well, also, had you reacted in the way you mentioned, hooking and hollering, this would have been at least a propaganda victory for them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, because we maintained to the end, you know. Again, as the Fighting Man's Code of Conduct says, even though you're a prisoner of war, you're still a fair American fighting man responsible for your actions and dedicated to the principles made your country free. You know, and a lot of that goes with, okay, take the tone of the senior ranking officer and conduct yourself in a military fashion. So it was... It was pretty sedate day, but that's how we found out that the war was over.
Well, when did you actually come to believe that it was going to happen?
When the airplane broke the ground, and we were airborne. When the Vietnamese came in and gave us, actually, to back up a little bit, when the Vietnamese came in, gave us the clothes that you saw on TV when we came out, mm-hmm. which were not clothes we'd had, you know, a day before. We had sandals and pajamas, and they came in with shoes and trousers or shirt and a coat, and a little bag to put your stuff in, take all your trophies. That's when you kind of started thinking, okay, maybe it's going to happen. And then when the American uniformed military officer came into the camp, no question that he was an American military officer, and we found out that he went and talked to the senior ranking guy in each of the groups, in my case, Navy Lieutenant Commander Jim Peary and Colonel Norm Gaddis, senior Air Force guy, and he said, okay, the war is over. This is a legitimate release. This is not an early release. This is not propaganda. Go.
Prior to that, was there a noticeable improvement in conditions in terms of food or less beatings?
I'd probably say the last month, after Christmas of 1972. But again, I was up at a camp on the Chinese border where mm-hmm. there's just no hint that the Linebacker 2 operation, the B-52 raids, were happening downtown Hanoi. The guards were a little, they knew what was going on. And they started acting, in hindsight, the guards started acting a little differently. And then either they were a little more aggressive and mean because people were bombing and killing Vietnamese downtown. So there was some of that. And then at the same time, there were other guards who would make, oblique references to war ends soon, you go home soon, things like that. But didn't, the context wasn't there to really understand or believe what they were saying. And then I believe the day was the 13th of January, and they packed us all back up in the trucks. And this time they didn't blindfold us. They didn't handcuff us, as they had when they took us up to that camp. And the trip that took 3 days to get up into the mountains took about 1 day to get back down, going mm-hmm. downhill or something. And they put us in the bigger rooms in a different part of the Hanoi Hilton. And I think now there were like 15 or 16 or 20 guys in a room that I was in there, and we started to begin to understand that something had happened. And then, as I said, on the 22nd, the Vietnamese got us out in the formation and told us that the war was over.
Well, what had happened was, in my opinion at any rate, was Linebacker 2.
Oh, yeah.
That finally got their attention.
Well, the guys were in Hanoi at the time. They have a very different story about what was going on. When the earth was rocking and rolling, and the airplanes were falling out of the sky, and the missiles were going up. I mean, it might have been quite an exciting fireworks show there for a few days, but we missed all of that up on the Briar Patch camp.
Tell me about coming home.
Coming home, it's an interesting thing. After 6 years, you get kind of comfortable in a lifestyle. It's not a good lifestyle, but you're comfortable with it. And all of a sudden, somebody tells you that you're going to go home. Well, you don't know what you're going home to. It could be a good family situation. It could be a bad family situation. You may learn something that is life-threatening that you don't want to know that you can be in denial. I mean, I, for example, hadn't eaten anything solid in 2 years because of some rather severe jaw and teeth damage that the Vietnamese did to me. I knew I felt bad, but I didn't know why. But I was comfortable. It was okay. But I wasn't really wanted to go home and find out that, maybe you had cancer, or maybe you had to have major surgeries, or what kind of an environment you're going into. And maybe all this anti-war stuff is true. And I'm a young fellow. I'm, 30, coming up on 30 years old. My military career, my classmates from the academy were all much more experienced, much more seasoned than I'm behind. What are you going to do? So there's a lot of professional uncertainty, a lot of personal uncertainty about what you're going back into. And it was a little scary. And I would say that at the same time, we had an experience that as you could see maybe downstairs in the thing this morning, when we get together, we are a different bunch of guys when we interact with each other than we are individually.
Our thanks to retired Air Force General Edward Beckenbauer for sharing his experiences with us this week on Veterans Chronicles.
That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles, produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Sullivan area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.